Okay, here we go.
The signs, they do a very good job. They put a sign that says we've moved here, here. That's supposed to be, I hope that sign's on the other door. Okay. Does anybody have any questions I can answer? Two possibilities. The homework's too easy, or you haven't started on it yet, right? Okay. So this is day two. I'll be away for days 4, 5, and 6. My plan is to record some videos for you all. So the homework for today will not be due until like day 7. So. Number 4, 1.6 number 7, 1.7 number 5, and let's see. And here's some graduate student homework. So what this is the infinitary form of the distributive law for how you distribute intersections over unions. Okay. And so the sets involved could all be infinite. So if I take an intersection of unions, what is the... And I want to bring the unions in. I want to bring the intersections inside the union operation. What does that look like? Well, I claim that it looks like this. I claim you can prove it too. That F there is the set of all functions from I to J. Okay. As usual, if you want to prove two sets are equal, if all else fails, prove that everything in here is in here, and that everything on the right side is conversely in the left side. So 1.6 and 1.7 are about functions and equivalence relations. Now, you can think of all of those things. If you want to get really abstract, you can think of them all as special cases of a binary relation. Who can tell me what a binary relation is? Yes, Joshua.
I guess informally, where you take two objects from the set, it'll give you another object from that same set, informally speaking.
That's a binary operation. Yeah, we're close. Yes, addition is a binary operation. The input is two things from some set, and the output is another thing from that set. Right? Two reals, add them, you get a real. A binary relation is where the input is two things, and the output is true or false. Right? As in, like the relationship of, like take two people. One person is an ancestor of the other person or not, right? That's a binary relation. If you want to do that in terms of set theory, it just becomes, you can just code it as the set of all things for which the output is true. Okay. So when we think in terms of sets, it's just like this. A binary relation R is a subset of some Cartesian product. And that's it. So it's just a bunch of ordered pairs. So, for example, I could have something like this. I could think of this symbol, the same thing about the real numbers, as a set. I could think of it as the set of all x, comma y, where x is less than y. That's how I could think of it. So, if you wanted to graph, if you wanted to graph this thing, you would graph all the points where the x coordinate is less than the y coordinate. So, that would be all the stuff to the left of the diagonal. So in this case, it's a subset of Cartesian product of the reals with itself. And functions, the way I like to think of a function, not everybody likes to think of it this way, but I like to think of a function as just a very special binary relation. Okay, so let's have something really, really simple here. Here's A. Here's B. And so, for example, if I had R as the following set, this is a binary relation, right? Because it's a set of ordered pairs. That's all binary relation is. It's just a bunch of ordered pairs. But this is a nice set of ordered pairs in that for every A in capital A there, for each of 1, 2, and 3, There is one and only one B in B satisfying this property, that AB is in that binary relation R. So basically, this is the vertical line test. So when you have this property, we say that R is a function from A to B. Capital A to capital B. And for that unique B there that had A comma B and R, well, we write this in the traditional way. We write R, we use functional notation now.
So that's how I think about functions. They're just special ordered pairs. They have to pass the vertical line test.
Now, you could have other things that don't pass the vertical line test. There's kind of two ways you could fail to pass the vertical line test. You could have 2 points or more on a vertical line, right? Or you could have none, right? You miss a vertical line. So you can give non-examples, right? So. See, this one, you know, for 2, there you have to go to 5. For 1, you have to go to 4. To 3, you have to go to 4. It passes the vertical line test. But what if I left one out? This is not a function. From A to B. But it is a function from... from a smaller set to B, right? The domain, it does take everything in 2 and 3 to B, okay? And the other thing is that if you make this set here bigger, it doesn't hurt anything, right? As far as if B is a subset of C and F is a function from A to B, then F is a function from A to C as well, right? So like in this example, I could add more, right? In my example over there, if I had had more points here, it doesn't change anything. The vertical line test is doing a test at each point on what we call the domain, right? It's saying, for each of 1, 2, and 3, is there exactly one thing over here that's R related to them? So there's yes, right? We still have that 1 is related to 4, and nothing else is related to 1. 5 is related to 2, nothing else is related to 2. 4 is related to 3, and nothing else is related to 3. The fact that, you know, nothing is related, the fact that 1, 2, 3, 6, and 7 here are not related to anything is irrelevant. Now, there's various names for these things. Different authors have different preferences. What Kroon likes to do is this B here gets called the codomain or the range. And as you can see, that's a little bit ambiguous because you can always make this thing bigger and it doesn't, and your function is still a function. So there's a little bit of an ambiguity there. And at least though on the other side, you know, this the A here, right? This thing, the domain, that's unambiguous. If I give you R here, you can tell me what the domain is. Right? If I tried to make the domain bigger, I would have to make R bigger so that I wouldn't be missing stuff. As I said, the codomain or range R is kind of, all you know is the sort of the relation itself that encodes your function, right? Then that there's not a unique answer as to what is its range or codomain, but you can at least say what it has to include. Want to talk about exactly this thing, the set of all things that are related to some x, right, according to R. This would be called the image of R in Kroon's terminology. Not super interesting. It's a way of encoding functions. But what I find more interesting is when you start thinking about other kinds of binary relations beside functions. Okay. So, lots of other kinds of binary relations you can think of. So let me mention a few of them. So there's some classic properties. A binary relation R is transitive if whenever you have two things, so if X is related to Y and Y is related to Z, then you want that to imply that XZ is, or X is related to Z. And sometimes people like to write stuff like this in a more suggestive symbolic notation, like this. They use a double arrow for the implies, and for the binary relation, they write it with what's called infix notation. It's
So if you think of that R as like a less than sign or something, then that makes sense. If F is less than Y, is less than Z, then X is less than Z. And then you have, then you can do more properties. So let's say you wanted to axiomatize linear orders, strict linear orders. Okay. Binary relation R is anti-symmetric if whenever you have this relation, the converse relation is false. But you might just want to say the same thing. Maybe you don't want a linear order. Maybe you want what we call an equivalence relation. And then you do want symmetry. If you're thinking of less than, if x is less than y, you better not have y less than x. But if you're thinking equivalence, right, like if x is equal to y mod 5, then y is equal to x mod 5. And then there's a similar pair of things. If you're thinking less than, you don't want x to be less than x, right? So one way you might formalize that is if whenever you have things related, then they're different. But on the other hand, if you're thinking about an equivalence relation, then you want the opposite thing. You want reflexive. And so how do we get the opposite thing? Well, we want to say for everything in the domain of our relation, we want to be related to itself. If you graph it, if you graph these things, then these four properties are all related to the diagonal. This kind of thing says that if you have something on the diagonal, then its mirror image, if you have something in the relation, its mirror image across the diagonal is excluded. This one says if you have something, then its mirror image across the diagonal has to also be in there. This one just says that we avoid the diagonal. This one says we include the diagonal. This one, I'm not sure. Let's see. How can I indicate this? So an equivalence relation on a set A is a transitive symmetric reflexive binary relation with domain A. And then it all it all makes sense in terms of equivalences, right? You want to say, if you read it as is equivalent, you know, if X is equivalent to Y and Y is equivalent to Z, then X should be equivalent to Z, whatever equivalent is supposed to mean. And if X is equivalent to Y, then Y should be equivalent to X. And X should be equivalent to itself. If you take those antis, right, if you turn symmetric into anti-symmetric and reflexive into irreflexive, then you've got something a little different.
You've got what's called a partial order.
Partial order on a set A is a transitive anti-symmetric irreflexive binary relation with domain A subset of A.
Now, if you want a linear order, you need a little bit more. See, the problem with a partial order, as I've defined it, is you could have the empty set that says nothing is related to anything else. And that would satisfy transitivity, anti-symmetry, and irreflexivity. Because if nothing is related to anything, then no X is related to itself, so it's irreflexive. And if nothing's related to anything, then this hypothesis here is never satisfied. So this property is trivially true. And this hypothesis is also trivially is never satisfied. So the implication is trivially true, right? The symmetry and transitivity are only interesting if you actually have some relations to start with. Because they tell you, given some relations, you get more relations. So, what would you need to make something a linear order?
What's the missing property you need for a linear order? Think about our example here. Transitive. I'm not aware of something that's like kind of the opposite. I mean, I don't think that's really been looked at. I mean, you could ask for something like that. If X is related to Y and Y is related to Z, then I demand that X not be related to Z. But
I haven't seen that studied, to be honest, so maybe you should look into that. Maybe somebody studied it, but it never produced anything interesting in the sense that it was not connected to the rest of mathematics. But there might be something interesting there. I just don't know about it. Think about that main diagonal again. Right?
Irreflexive just says we avoid the main diagonal. Anti-symmetric, right, says that if you have one point off the diagonal, you do not have its mirror image. Now think about my graph here of the less than relation. If I have a point off the diagonal and then I have its mirror image, right? That's those two points, point and its mirror image. How many of those points are in the relations graph?
One.
So, and no matter which point I pick, right? If I take any point and I look at its mirror image, so assuming I take a point off the diagonal, and then I look at its mirror image, I always get exactly one of them in the relation. In other words, x, if I have distinct reals x and y, x is less than y, or y is less than x, but not both. Right? The anti-symmetry is what says not both. But to be a linear order, you need at least one of them to happen. Okay? So, a linear order on A is a partial order with the property that for all distinct x and y in A, let's call it P. It's a partial order P where either X is related to, X is P related to Y, or Y is P related to X. So that's how a linear order works. These are very abstract things. You want to think of what's going on is taking something familiar, like actual equality, and abstracting out the key properties. Transitivity says it's kind of an abstraction of the property of x equals y and y equals z, then x equals z. And symmetry, if x equals y, then y equals x. Reflexivity, x should equal x. And then these other kind of properties with the antis, they're kind of abstracting like a less than relation, right? Transitivity works for both. If x is less than y, it's less than z, then x is less than z. If x is less than y, then y is not less than x. Up here. If x is less than y, then y is not less than x. If x is less than y, then x and y are not the same thing. And then one other thing you need with a linear order is you need this property that if x is less than y, either x is less than y or y is less than x, or x and y are actually the same. But if x and y are different, then you better have one of those two. And there are different names for this. Sometimes people call this property completeness, although other people use completeness to mean something different. Tell you that. There's a natural example where you want to make up a linear order that's not just the usual one,
You might think, oh, I've got the linear order of the reals, and that gives me a linear order of all other things I like the natural numbers, the rational numbers, the integers. Why don't you think of, you know, abstract linear orders? Well, you actually have thought about them already. You think of, what if I had two new things? I'll call them infinity and negative infinity. I guess the plus is kind of redundant there. Right? So I imagine the real line, but now I want to throw in some new things to it, right? Sometimes people will write this kind of suggestive notation like that. There's a natural way to define a linear order on this, right? You want to say that negative infinity is less than all the reals, and that positive infinity is greater than all the reals, okay? So it's very natural. You want to define something like this. You want to have, what am I call it? I'll just call it this, okay? The natural ordering you want to have on this is you want to have all of anything, for any two reals, if x is less than y and x and y are reals, then you should still have x is less than y in this bigger thing. But we also need to throw in some ordered pairs to explain things like I want negative infinity to be less than every real. Okay. So I throw in negative infinity comma x for all x real. But I need more. I also need that every real is less than my positive infinity. And I need one more thing to make this a linear order. What do I need? It's not quite a linear order yet. This is not a transitive relation, right? If I choose x to be 5, negative infinity is less than 5, and 5 is less than infinity, but I haven't thrown in that negative infinity is less than infinity yet. That's what's missing. So just throw in one more ordered pair, okay? Now you've got it. You could draw a kind of conceptual diagram of this. You could kind of think of the real line, but then somehow it's like, you know, here's 1, or negative 1, negative 10, negative 100, and so on. Somehow the real line is getting sort of squished, right? 1, 10, 100, and so on. Kind of squish the real line until you can have your infinity there. So we're excluding that diagonal there. And then what are we going to have? We're going to have everything to the left of that diagonal, just like here. So you get, like before, you get any pair of reals, x comma y, where x is less than y in the usual sense. But then we get some new stuff. The new stuff we get is that negative infinity is less than every real x, and so that brings us this thing right here. Maybe we can use color, right? That was the new part. That's, so you get that. And on the other hand, every real x is supposed to be less than positive infinity. Okay? So we also get that. And then we also need to throw in that corner, right? So this is a very common kind of phenomenon for where you need to abstract away from your concrete stuff with, say, the real number line, is when you have some kind of infinity concept that you need to incorporate, right? So a lot of times, we're thinking about, you want for some reason you want to be able to compare to plus or minus infinity. You have to abstract away from just the normal ordering. But then once you throw in this new stuff, you have to check that it still has some good properties, and that amounts to checking that yes, it is still a linear order according to our definition. And there are other things where that happens, like when we talk about the limit as x approaches infinity. That is something that goes beyond the concrete stuff with the real line, and talking about getting epsilon close to some real number. Right? Because how? Because you can't get close to infinity. This is an example of abstraction. So this is a linear order. Now, if you want an example of something that's, say, a partial order but not a linear order, the classic example would be divisibility, right? Look at the natural numbers, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, and look at things where, look at the relation that says n divides n. 3 divides 6, 3 does not divide 7. Right? That is a partial order on the natural numbers. Okay. It's not a it satisfies transitivity, right? If A divides B and B divides C, then A divides C. It's
not, okay, so, okay, I lied a little bit. It's technically, the way I've written it, it's not irreflexive, so. So I guess I'll have to.
Technically, every number divides itself, so it's not really a partial. Some people define partial order differently. The definition I've given over there is called a strict partial order. Some people say that
some people want to throw in the diagonal, right? They keep the anti-symmetry axiom for off-diagonal elements, but they allow it to be reflexive. But the definition I'm using here, I'm going to need to say,
all pairs of distinct natural numbers where the first one divides the second one.
Right.
But this is not a linear order, right? Because if I have two numbers that are relatively prime, like say 3 and 8, 3 does not divide 8 and 8 does not divide 3. Right? So it's not like a linear order, right? In linear order, you say, you know, 3 is less than 8 or 8 is less than 3, right? Partial orders come up in another very important context.
Okay.
This is probably the most important kind of partial order. So, I didn't talk about it last time, but in your reading you should have read about the power set, right? This is the set of all sets B, where B is a subset of A. It's just the set of all subsets of A.
And when I
instead of ending the sentence there, when I go out and tell you a little bit more. And if you consider this is the following relation, so what this means is B is a subset of C, the little not equals there just means strict subset, okay? So, subset, but not the same thing,
okay?
So, if B is a subset of C, but in the strict sense of not being the same as C, and they're both subsets of A, right? This is a partial order on the power set of A, right? And you know, more generally, if you had any collection of sets, this is one of the most natural ways to partially order them. It's just by inclusion, right? You just say B is related to C if B is a proper subset of C. But in general, it's not a linear order, right? Because you can have one set that has, say, you know, 2 and 5, and another set that has 5 and 7. Neither one is a subset of the other. So in general, this is not a linear order. I mean, if A here has just one element or no elements, then it will be a linear order because there won't be very many subsets. But As long as you've got at least, let's see. Yeah, as long as you've got at least two elements, then you'll have incomparable subsets. Like if A has 3 and 5, then you can form the set that just has 3 and the set that just has 5. And neither one is a subset of the other. Now, I know the book hasn't really talked about linear orders or partial orders. That's what I'm telling it to you now, because I'm going to come back to it later. There's something when we get to some more advanced topics, it's called a Zorn's lemma. And I wanted to lay some of the groundwork for that by telling you, maybe you've already seen this before, at least reminding you of what a partial order is and a linear order is. Yeah, very abstract. But let me go back now to the equivalence relations. Okay. So I claim that every equivalence relation can be captured essentially by a function. And conversely, every function determines an equivalence relation. So what do I mean by that? So if E is an equivalence relation on X, then there is a function f with domain x such that everything in E, so remember E is just a bunch of pairs x comma y, but I claim that you can always cook up a function f such that x is e related to y if and only if f of x is the same as f of y. In other words, there's always some function that you can use to transform this abstract equivalence into actual equality. Right? So remember, this is an equality here. So these two sets are the same. So that means if x and y are e-related, then their f values are the same. And conversely, if x and y are in the underlying set capital X and their f values are the same, then I claim that they're e-related. So this set encodes e perfectly. Or actually, the function encodes E perfectly. The set just is E. And how do you prove that? Any ideas? Basically, given E, we need to cook up a function that kind of gives E back to us in some way. It's very abstract. We don't know much about E. All we really know is that E satisfies these abstract properties.
transitive, symmetric, reflexive.
So for any element of capital X, you need to have something to be the output. And we need that something to be the same for all the Ys that are E related to X. Okay. And that's something that's probably going to depend on E somehow. Now, I'll tell you that the standard trick here is you just consider the set of all Y that are E related to X. Okay. That's the trick.
It's a little bit abstract because the function here doesn't map it back into capital X or something. Instead, it maps into the power set of X, right? It maps to a set of elements of X. So this is how you define the function, right? If you wanted things in terms of, notice I've just used the function notation here, but if you wanted to do it in terms of pairs, right, it would look like this. You would say F is the set of all pairs of the form X, comma, the set of all Y, where X, comma, Y is an E, right? Where X is an X.
But when people are defining functions, they usually like to use functional notation. Okay, so that's our function. Input X, output, set of everything related to X. So now I have to prove that this is actually going to give me the right thing here, right? So if, let's say I have P and Q are related, right? Then I claim that F of P equals F of Q. But how do I prove it? Well, I have to go through the definitions. So I'm going to kind of work backwards from my goal here. Okay. So F of P equals F of Q because what? Because the set of all Y where Y is related to P equals the set of all Y where Y is related to Q. But why are those sets the same? Well, you have to show that anything in this set is in that set, and conversely, anything in this set is in that set. So here's how it goes. Let's suppose we have this, right? Okay. Well, I'm going to rewrite this in terms of what's called, you know, this infix notation, where you, to indicate the relation, you just put the relation symbol in the middle. It's a little easier to read. Okay. This implies by symmetry, since E is an equivalence relation, that Y is related to P, Ah, but P is related to Q.
Okay.
So I use some symmetry. And then I use a transitivity to say that, therefore Y is related to Q, which is just... but then what do I need? I need to go back to Q is related to Y, which is just another way of writing that Q comma Y is in E. And the same argument works in reverse, right? If I had started with a Q here, maybe I should just write it down. Be more convincing. And I'm using these little double arrows to indicate implications. Like, if this is true, then this is true. Right? Double arrow means if this is true, then this is true, and if this is true, then this is true. Right? So. So I guess if I want to show the other half, then I can't quite end the sentence yet. So I have to add that little argument there, and I have to say, and if you're going the other way, right, in terms of ordered pairs, if I write this, if I write an infix notation, it would look like that. Okay, but now what I want is to, I need to make use of the P related to Q business. Well, okay. Well, but wait a minute. This, we already know that P is related to Q. So I can just throw in that extra fact because I'm assuming that right here. So that's not news. And then, just go a little further. And then you use transitivity again. Just, the only difference is here we're using transitivity first. We didn't need to use the symmetry because basically things are already in the right order for us. And if we use this ordered pair notation instead of this infix notation, as it's called, so that half is actually easier because the P and the Q were already in the right order, so to speak. Questions or comments about that little argument there?
I have a question.
Yes.
And how to get the second arrow?
Like here?
Yes.
Well, because I'm assuming that P is related to Q. So I'm not adding any new information. That information is already there. Nothing has changed here, right? If Q is related to Y, then it's also true that P is related to Q and Q is related to Y. Because we already had assumed that P was related to Q. So I haven't said anything new here, right? And you know, conversely, you know, if I have this and I forget about this, I get that. So this implies that, and that implies that. So, I mean, if you like, you could put a little, you know, this is our hypothesis being used here, right? Right. But I don't know, that seems a little bit, that's overdoing the annotation, I think. I'm just using my hypothesis here. I'm almost done with this little proof here, except I need to do the converse, right? I show if P and Q are E-related, then this funny function spits out the same sets, right? F of P and F of Q have to be the same set. And so, let's see, conversely, if let's say I have, I'll use different letters this time. If I have R and S in capital X, and F of R equals F of S, then I need to show that R comma S is an E. That's what I'm going to kind of work backwards again. I'm going to say this. Because what? Well, first of all, notice that in the definition, if I could just show that I had RS, right, in there, one way I could get this is if I show that S is in F of R, because what is F of R? It's just a set of all things that are related to R. So if I could show that S is in here, then I'd have exactly what I needed. If S is actually in that set. Okay. But F of R is the same as F of S. So to show that S is in this set, that S is one of those Ys, it's enough for me to show that S is in F of S. Which is all the things that are E related to S. So I just need to show that S is one of those Ys. So I just need to show that S is related to S. But that's just reflexivity. We already know that S is related to itself because we have an equivalence relation. So what this funny function does, if you want to use fancy words for it, is it maps each function or each element of X to its equivalence class. That's the word for these sets. Okay? So if you want an example of this, you have, say, X is the natural numbers, and E is the set of all things, say M comma N. M and N are both natural numbers, and M equals N mod 3. This is an equivalence relation, and then F would just be the set of all things that are related to M according to this relation. So that would be M, M plus 3, M plus 6, M plus 9, M plus 12, and so on. And then you'd also have to have all the stuff less than M that was equal to M mod 3. But I don't want to go below 0, so... So that one's a little dot, dot, dot. So how far does this go? Well, it would have to stop somewhere, right? You don't want to go down to 0 because I'm just doing the natural numbers. So I just need to quit when I get to,
3k less than m, less than or equal to 3 times k plus 1.
So all the things, all the natural numbers equal to n mod 3. This is the equivalence class of n with respect to that equivalence relation. So this is what I mean. Anytime you have an equivalence relation, there's actually a function, and it's just the equivalence class function, which is a transformation that turns equivalence into equality there. Two things are equivalent if and only if their equivalence classes are identical as sets. Classes can be encoded by functions in that sense, and conversely, if you have any function, it naturally encodes an equivalence class, right? So if I have two sets x and y, and I have a function g from x to y, we can define an equivalence class on these. An equivalence class on X based on G. If any two things have the same G value, then we say they're equivalent. I'm going to call this one. Goes both ways. And here's a proof. Very easy. Much easier than that one. Much less abstract. Right? It's easy. G of A equals G of A. G of A equals G of B if and only if G of B equals G of A. And if G of A equals G of B, and G of B equals G of C, then, yeah, G of A equals G of C. And this is true for all A, B, C in capital X. Okay? So it's an equivalence relation, basically, because equality is equivalence relation. And it's interacting very nicely with equality, right? I think of it as like equality is basically a diagonal on y, well, really y times y. You have the diagonal, right? Equality for y, right? And what we're doing is we're looking at the shadow cast by I'll do a very crude diagram. It's like this. It's like G, if you look at all the stuff that G maps to that diagonal, it's not quite G, it's G comma G, right? Take any A comma B, and then maybe they get mapped over here to G of A comma G of B, and they're on the diagonal because they got mapped to the same thing. Because I have some C comma D over here, I apply G to each coordinate, and maybe it maps to something where G of C and G of D are different, right? So it really, you think of it as the shadow of the diagonal, given. And how you go from the actual diagonal over here in Y back to this shadow in X
is you, G tells you the way the light goes, basically. So you think of, I guess the light goes in the opposite direction as G. If you want to be fancy, this is the tensor squared G. I wrote G comma G because I'm applying G to each coordinate. Right? G to the first coordinate, G to the second coordinate. So what this is saying in very high level terms or poetic terms is any shadow of a diagonal in this precise sense, really this precise sense, right, is an equivalence relation. And what I did over here was I said that actually for any equivalence relation, I can find a map from X into the power set of X that is such that the diagonal in the power set of X, right, just equality of sets, its shadow with respect to this funny map is exactly some arbitrary equivalence relation. So shadows of the diagonal are equivalence relations, and every equivalence relation is actually the shadow of a diagonal too. So. Now there's a notation. There's a number of different notations out there, but the notation Prüm uses for the equivalence class is you just put brackets around an element. So I used that function f I cooked up. Krum doesn't write f of x. He's going to write x in brackets. Okay. And as I've been saying verbally, but now I finally write down, this is called the E equivalence class of X. And you'll note that it's exactly our F over here. So we're going to have that exact same thing, that two things are equivalent if and only if their equivalence classes are identical. And if you're looking at this proof, you see various properties that fall out. Right? That proof, and then the rest of the proof over here. Right? Since an equivalence class is reflexive, right? You always have E is anything X. It's always in its own equivalence class. Right? And then, as I said before, right? X and Y are equivalent if and only if their equivalence classes are equal. But by what I proved over here, right, you also have, if you're looking at the definitions, and I guess you don't need the proof, right, just read the definition. X and Y are equivalent if and only if Y is in the equivalence class of X by definition. But then remember, things are symmetric, right? X is equivalent to Y if and only if Y is equivalent to X. So if you turn that around, you have the same thing. Okay. So those are all. So those implications all work both directions. This is true if and only if this is true, if and only if this is true, if and only if that is true. Now here's here's one that uses transitivity. If two equivalence classes are different, then I claim that they have nothing in common. So if they're different sets, they're actually disjoint sets. Well, why? If you had Z in both, then you'll get a little contradiction here, right? Because if you have Z in both, then that means you have X related to Z and Y related to Z, but it's symmetric, so you can turn things around. So Z is related to Y. But then by transitivity, X is related to Y. But if X is related to Y, then they have the same equivalence class. So this gives us another way of thinking about equivalence relations. There are partitions, right? If I have X, then what happens is everything that if I have something, then all the stuff that it's equivalent with gets put together into an equivalence class, right? So it breaks X up into these non-overlapping sets, right? Like over here, with this mod 3 equivalence, you break up the natural numbers into exactly 3 sets. There's all the stuff equivalent to 1 mod 3, there's all the stuff equivalent to 2 mod 3, there's all the stuff equivalent to 3 mod 3. There's nothing beyond that, because if you're equivalent to 4 mod 3, you're equivalent to 1 mod 3, and so on. And you can't be equivalent to 1, 2, or 3 mod 3, in two ways at the same time. You can't be equivalent to 1 and 2 mod 3. You can't be equivalent to 1 and 3 mod 3. You can't be equivalent to 2 and 3 mod 3. Right? So f of 1, f of 2, and f of 3 are all disjoint. Right? Nothing in common. So those are the kind of three ways I think about equivalence relations. I think about them as just some abstract generalization of the quality that has those axioms of reflexivity, symmetry, and transitivity. Then I think about it in terms of shadows of equality given by some function. And then I think about it in terms of partitions. I cut up my set into some pieces such that everything in a piece is equivalent to everything else in that piece. But stuff in different pieces is never equivalent. Two things from different pieces are never equivalent to each other. And, I apologize, I just looked at my watch and I'm time. Okay. So, it was a little bit heavy on the binary relations, but I wanted to fill in some stuff where I felt like the book didn't say what I was hoping to say. Okay. Any questions or comments?